Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis. This is Literary Viewpoints, MJ Network, in memory of my sister, Marcia Joyce. And I want to welcome you to the show. It's beautiful. The holidays are about to begin, and there's nothing like buying a million books for everybody. We have a fantastic show and a great author here, and I'm really pleased to say the sun is finally coming out, even though it's 20 degrees here. So good morning, Gerard. How you doing? Hello? That's weird.
Well, good morning, everybody.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
I can hear you
now
fine.
I couldn't hear you before. I got nervous. I couldn't hear you before. I said, oh, my God. In case you're wondering, everybody, what happened the last time I interviewed Gerard? I'll spill. There was a bat in my apartment, and that's what I was saying. What is that? There was a bat flying over my head, and I hope he doesn't come back flying today. They think he's gone, but the rabies shots are very painful. That's all I'll say about that. So, no, I'm serious, and that's why.
Well, let's just hope that you don't
happened.
Have any bats in your belfry, Fran. If the bats are just around, that's a better thing. So we don't.
Yeah, no. Well, he was flying over my head, and unfortunately, he caused me to have to go to the ER right after the show. To get rabies shots and a whole bunch more. And for those of you that don't know it, they really hurt, but not that bad. It was nothing I can't handle, really. I don't even want to know. So we have the author of a brand-new series, Joshua's Country. And before I start, Marcia Caswell-Cook is going to probably check in and listen afterwards. And Marcia and I are going to be starting a brand-new show starting either January or February. We're not going to talk about books. We're going to talk about fashion, style, cars, sports, anything that comes to our mind. And
wow.
For those of you that don't know, yeah, I decided I need to do something, different. On February 8th, I'm going to be doing a show with Kate Genovese, who lost her son to drug addiction, and to Mike Embry, that wrote a story about a drug addiction. And Marcia's listening. Yeah, she's there. And I'm going to be talking about opiate and opiate addiction. And I was looking for a medical advisor, and unfortunately the person I wanted can't make it, but that's okay. We'll do fine. So, born and raised in cowboy Vietnam, that Joshua Jacobs looks out across the West Texas plain, all the land stretching to the uncluttered western horizon. He says, this man is very powerful. And if you think Christian Arrow was tough, you don't want to mess with this guy either. Forget it. Don't even want to think about it. So he deeply regretted not being able to speak on terms with his only son when James died serving his country. James' wife, Katie, never forgave Joshua for trying to run their lives. Now, I'm not going to tell you anymore. The author is here. He's going to tell you about this guy and why you don't want to mess with him and how we started it. So how did you create Joshua's Country?
Well, first of all, it's not a series. It's a standalone. So that's it. That's all you get with Joshua.
Oh, you got to get more.
I know. Actually, I have a lot of people come, but Joshua's a very private individual, as you read.
Yeah.
And it was covering a point in his life that I thought was significant. You know, to me, the characters are living, breathing people to me. So, mm-hmm. Joshua came to me when I just posed the question of. You see the Islamic terrorists, and the Christian Nero series deals with all these current events and the military people and the high tech people. And, I grew up watching old Westerns with my dad, old John Wayne Westerns and, Alan Ladd and, Gary Cooper. And I just pondered the thought of what would happen if one of these, terrorist Islamic hateful terrorist ran into just an old American cowboy, and that's where the whole idea came from.
That was a really interesting one too, and kind of scary. The ending is like, I'm not going to tell anybody that. It's any business. You'll have to read it. So what research did you do before writing this novel, and tell listeners about the article you cited in the author's notes and why? You see, I read everything. That just shows I read to the end of the book.
Well, the I didn't have to do a whole lot of research for Joshua's, because I do so much research for the Chris De Niro books, and it was so the antagonist, an Islamic terrorist, Jihad Johnny, was based off of, it was that guy a couple of years ago, and he's dead now, but who was beheading people with the this handheld knife, and it just got me sick to my stomach, and that's, all of my books are driven from some sort of very, very powerful emotion. So when I saw those images, that's when I started pondering the question, and that's what, so I didn't really, I was already doing research for the other books, and Joshua's Country was an interesting one. It's the only thing that I've written with where I had, I don't write for the screen. The stuff that I'm doing now for TV and for movies, I've already told you, it came completely from a different direction. It came from Mike Greenberg, the creator of MacGyver and Stargate, reading my books. So I don't have an agent in Hollywood. I wasn't doing any of those things, and so he came to it. I don't write for the screen, but with Joshua's, I wrote for a specific actor. I had a specific actor in my mind who was Tommy Lee Jones. And he was in my mind when I came up with the – I needed an old cantankerous cowboy from Southwest Texas. Tommy Lee is from Southwest Texas. My partner, Mike, is managed by the same guy that is managed by Tommy Lee. So I know a little bit about him personally. And I was like, boy, he's just the right – I mean, actors can play anybody. Great actors can play anybody. I could get Robert Downey Jr. He's a great actor. He could play. Never underestimate how talented actors are. But Tommy Lee was born for this thing. So I was really fired up. Actually, it's going through the motions of getting to Tommy. Tommy's a very private person. He's like Joshua. He's a very private person, so we're going to see if he'd be interested in doing the project, and we do it as an independent film. But that really, I normally don't say that, because when you're a reader, you cast the characters. You may have a completely different idea, and I normally, like with Chris De Niro, I don't like to share who I think should play Chris or play who or play this. But in this case, because it was the very foundation of how I wrote the book,
Well, we won't say anything about Chris De Niro because there's an awful lot of good actors that might be able to play him, but that has to be somebody that is actually him. It probably should be somebody that actually experienced 9/11 or knows more about 9/11 also.
That's a good,
before
that's
he
can
play
good,
that.
Good point, Fran. And we actually do have those things in there. Again, I was written, the speech that I just gave about talented actors can do anything was actually said to me by agents that are handing us on that. They wanted me to know that, hey, listen, because I wanted somebody I wanted an East Coast perspective, and I was making the point of coming from a rock band, we were an East Coast-based rock band. Van Halen was a West Coast-based rock band. There was actually a difference in sound. If you talk to people that are into hip-hop music, they'll definitely tell you that East Coast hip-hop and West Coast hip-hop were two different styles. You may not know it if you don't know hip-hop, or rock music in the case of us. The same thing I was saying about actors. I said, I would love to have, for Chris, I'd love to have somebody with the New York flavor. And like you say, anybody who's around New York knew somebody or at least feels that deep emotion from September 11. So we'll see. We'll see where it's going to go.
Unless you've experienced it. Yeah, I remember I was in school that day, and the nurse called me in, and she said, you're not going to believe this. And they replayed it. And I actually saw the second tower fall as it fell, and I thought I was in a horror movie. I could not believe it. It was the scariest thing ever. And then all of a sudden, everything went dark in the school, and we lost electricity. It was horrible.
The interesting thing too with that is when Mike Greenberg came and contacted me, the first thing he said to me, he says, Gerard, he says, I read in the front matter in Watchmen of Ephraim, you lost a friend, Danny Aflito. I said, yeah, I did, in the North Tower. He says, I lost a friend. So we had that connection before I even knew the man. I guess that's why the book touched him so much. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Why would a big legendary producer from Hollywood call me? I mean, it was unusual to me that they just don't. Hollywood doesn't work that way. I don't think anybody can name anyone. you know, I'm putting it out there. If you know somebody that like got called because they wrote a book from a major producer in Hollywood, then I'd love to know about it, because I've never heard of it happening. It doesn't happen that way. But it was because Mike was really taken away. Because he called me. He didn't even finish the whole book. He says, I got up to the third chapter, that's where the tower falls. And he said, I had to reach out to you. I was like, oh, boy.
Okay. I understand. I lost a student that I had for 2 years at 9/11. And it was really weird because her grandmother came in, and I said, how's my Janine? She was just there to bring her nephew to school on the 9th, which is my birthday. And she said a month later, she said, we lost her in the first tower. You have no idea how crushed I was. I couldn't talk to anybody.
Yeah.
And every year on 9/11, when they show her picture, I take a picture with my phone and I post it on Facebook with something special. Because I don't know who remembers her, because none of her family is on Facebook. But let's talk about Joshua. And how come his son and he were estranged, and how come Katie is not too thrilled with him? Even though she's part of the book.
You know, as the story was coming to me with Joshua, it morphed from a counterterrorism novel or any of the things that with Kristen Nero, and it really occurred. The story just came to me as a family story. It was a story about a man who, West Texan, wildcatter, who struck it rich. But all the money in the world, the way he ran his business life, didn't translate to it. You know, he was his way or the highway guy. I mean, that's Joshua Jacobs. We all know in our families with our children, that's not how it works. So I explored that throughout the plot, and it to me, the book just took on a whole different dimension. It became a story that a lot of people connect with. Parents make mistakes. Joshua Jacobs made a mistake. He was a prideful man, and he paid for it. His son became estranged. He was a military guy, but he was a military guy in Vietnam. And, you know, those guys are kind of expatriates. They're the type of people that said, hey, I served my country. I was spit on when I came home, and I don't want anything to do with the government anymore. You know, you get a lot of the guys from the Vietnam era that unfortunately, you know, they went through that. And so that's how Joshua was. He didn't want his sons to follow in his footsteps, and his son did. And that was the point of the contention. He wanted his son to take over his huge ranch and take over his empire. And this, you know, it caused contention. And Katie was married to his son. And so Katie, when Joshua's son went over, and ultimately, you know, I don't want to give away the book, but, you know, things happen to him, and there you go. Now Katie points all that animosity towards she blames Joshua. And she kind of should, although they're two very strong-headed individuals. So you have a strong-headed character in Katie Jacobs, and now she has a son. So this is the story really revolves around Joshua, Katie, and Joshua's grandson.
That was my next question. Josh Jr. is headstrong, too, and he knows what he wants. And he goes and enlists in the Army, and his grandfather is having a fit, and his daughter-in-law is not happy. But why does he do it anyway? Why does he want to be in the Army? And this is where the bulk of the novel gets scary.
Yeah, you know what? This is kind of there's some personal in there. My dad was a Marine. He served in World War II and in Korea. My wife is an Army brat. Her dad was a major in the Green Beret, and her grandfather was a one-star general in the Army. We have, you know, vast amounts of family that are in the military, and there's different feelings. I remember when it was kind of from a personal experience. I had gone. Before I grew my hair ultra long and joined a heavy metal band, I was joining the Marines like my dad did when I was 17. And my dad came to me and said he didn't want me to join. And I said, I don't understand. You did. And he said it was a different era. And my father had gotten tainted from Korea. Korea was the first police action where Congress didn't make it a war. And my father kind of objected after serving for years in World War II. He enlisted. They called him back you know, in October 1950 for Inchon wasn't the battle that got him. It was the fact that, hey, wait a minute, is my country at war? Because, you know, if it is, then I'm going to go fight. And my father raised the same thing to me. This would have been in 79, right before Reagan did the attack with Grenada and we saved the people. I probably would have been in that. My father said, we're not at war, son. If we go to war, I will enlist with you. And so I remember those feelings, and I put that into Joshua's grandson. Great. Just because Joshua wants something, and this is where he ran into the problem with his own son. Remember, Joshua is getting a second chance. That was another aspect of the book. A sub-theme of the book is second chances. You know, we don't all make great first. I mean, I know I don't, at least. Not everything I say and do in my own family is right. And I get on my knees and pray for those second chances. That will I get a, you know, if I spoke too harshly to my son, or I didn't speak harshly enough on a subject, you know, those are all the things that are dealt with in Joshua. Joshua's really a family. There's so many family dynamics. So the grandson, even though his grandfather doesn't want him to join, he still wants to be like his dad, who died there. And now I gave it away, but he dies there because it's not really about his father as much as it's about the grandson. And he wanted to honor them. You know, that's what I wanted to do with my dad. It kind of infuriated me that my dad wasn't allowing me to honor him. But, you know, now being a dad myself, I understand what was going through I didn't at the time. So.
Well, that's interesting. My father was not supposed to enlist in the army because he had he got hit with a firecracker and it punctured his eardrum. But he enlisted in the Merchant Marines, which, from what I gathered, was horrible. But he did anyway.
10 times more. People in the Merchant Marines. The Merchant Marines were the people that delivered the goods necessary for us to win the war, yet they were not on many times those. Your father was an absolute hero of World War II. Absolutely.
Yeah,
it was World War II, I assume.
And then he was ostracized because he was Jewish, so made it even harder. It was really difficult.
Yes,
so,
the double difficulty.
Well, we have Joshua's Ranch, and he's surrounded by some heavy-duty metal there, heavy people. So why are they so loyal to him? And then this guy I really didn't like. Agent Herrera comes to the ranch, and you know right away that this guy is no good. Why was he there? And there were two illegals there. Why didn't Joshua give him up? Because this guy was really, he thought he was all together, all that. Oh my God.
Well, the whole story, the title of the book comes from the way the people in that part of Texas considered Joshua's ranch. They considered it a country unto itself because Joshua made the law there. It wasn't the government, federal government. It wasn't the state government. It wasn't any local government. I mean, in the middle of nowhere out there. Joshua, that was the kind of guy Joshua was. And because he was kind of an expatriate, he tended to, I mean, he had friends. You find out that the core of friends that he had came from the military, just like a lot of military people. Mm-hmm. They maintained their contacts. I know my dad did. He originally, when he was just, you know, building his ranch up in a ranch hand, he befriended guys that he grew up with in that general area that also served in the military with them. And that's where you get the characters like Pepper and Snake and those guys. But what Joshua does is you know, you speculate on buying land, and then you start poking holes in the ground. That's how it works. That's how wildcatting works. And it worked for Joshua, and he becomes extremely rich. And the ranch grows over a 20-year period. And who does he take in? You know, he's still that expatriate. You know, he's still that guy that's he's anti-government, leave me alone. And so you have Apaches that are down there. All those things are accurate. Everything that I put in the book is accurate. And so he has Apaches that are down there. Snake that he served with at Snake Villa, he was an Apache. So, you know, like Joshua doesn't really care what color skin you are. All he cares about is you're not going to lay around on his ranch and get a check. So the rules on Joshua's country are real simple. Do your job. It's like Bill Belichick on the New England Patriots. Do your job, you get to stay. I don't care what your background is. I don't care if you're loved by your mommy or by the government. If you do your job, you can stay. If you get into, you're going to cause me trouble, I'm going to kick your butt out. And that's why they lay that out very soon. Herrera is based on characters that I found out that not every border patrol agent was honest. You had corrupt ones. And so Herrera is a guy that is corrupt and gets transported. You know, instead of firing in the federal government, a lot of times what they do is they just move you. And you know, Catholic Church was like that with priests. If a priest got in trouble, they didn't excommunicate the priest. They'd send them to another parish. And the same thing with the federal government. So they move Herrera to that area. And Herrera is entrenched with the Mexican drug cartels. And that's where the story starts from. So Herrera is basically there because of two people that show up at the ranch who are related to somebody that works on the ranch. And that's where the whole that the beginning part of the book starts with that intrigue. And it's fun. It's fun to see Joshua go and deal with it. And they make, you know, the Apache at the gate. Let's that Herrera know, hey, listen, you know, listen, Jefe, this isn't the United States. Past these gates, this is Joshua's country, you know.
Now, that's what I thought was great, because they wanted him to hand over the two illegals. And he wasn't really sure why they were there, and he wasn't thrilled that they were there, but he wasn't going to send them out. So this is all of a sudden Katie becomes an integral part of this. And who is Benny? He's part of this group too, the illegals.
Yeah, well, you know, the funny thing about Joshua, I'll add to that, is Joshua is not, when I say he's unbiased, he doesn't care what color you are, he doesn't. But he's also a cantankerous old cowboy. So, you know, the Apaches, he's going to make Indian references. But they know, they respect him. People don't have problems generally. Ethnic, you know, you talk about Jewish, or you could be whatever you are. You could be black. You could be Jewish. People don't tend to push back when something is said as a tease. You know, I grew up in Brooklyn, and you know, I'm Spanish and Italian. Was I called a spick? Yeah, by friends that who love me. And I call, you know, and a WAP, and if they were a Mick, they were a Mick, and we all loved each other. And so it wasn't said with animosity, and it was kind of it actually helped in some ways, because it made us understand that we're actually making fun of the bias. We're not making fun of each other. We're making fun of the stupid bias. And so that's Joshua is not a guy that's not going to say a politically incorrect thing. He's going to say a ton of them. Pepper is kind of the guy, his second, who used to be his drill sergeant, and he knows him forever. And Pepper, I fashioned after Morgan Freeman. So if you ever in this book, I don't mind if I share the fact that Joshua really, to me, was Tommy Lee, and Pepper was Morgan Freeman. Another guy that was managed by my partner's manager. And so, you know, you have that. He's pushing back and telling Joshua off with those things. Benny, to get to the other thing, Benny is a grandson who went to school and comes back to the reservation. And so, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on that's not part of the main plot, but that's Joshua's country. There's, you know, you have these people, you have Herrera showing up, you have illegals showing up. Joshua doesn't want those illegals there, by the way. You know, he's not the, I'm going to protect the illegals. He's the guy that, up until he is protecting them, he's saying, what the hell, you know, what are these guys doing here? I don't want these people here, you know? So I think there's a little bit of wry humor built into Joshua's country.
So we have things happen fast in this book. How did you create that scene between Joshua, his men, Herrera, and the fact that it's based on a real life incident regarding drugs? I mean, how did you create that? Because I'm seeing they're saying, I'd like to punch the guy in the head too. And if I was standing there, I would do my kick and just, like, you know, take them down. What can I say? You know, girls from the Bronx.
I'm going to give away another thing. Again, from, you know, my generation of watching TVs, one of the Westerns that I watched starring Chuck Connors was a TV show called The Rifleman.
Oh, I loved him.
And remember Chuck Connors, big old, big, big actor. I mean, tall, big, like 6'6" actor. And in that, he's spinning, I think it was an 1895, it's a rifle that he spins, and everybody who's ever watched The Rifleman knows the rifle. And again, going back to the fact that this was going to be different than Chris De Niro. Joshua is not going to be wearing infrared, you know, glasses or night vision goggles, or, you know, he's not going to be shooting, you know, the next gen thing. He's an old cowboy. And the first weapon, I figured if he's going to carry any weapon, most cowboys that have real ranches carry that rifle. It's a Winchester. And I said, you know what? I'm going to have some fun with this. I'm going to put the bowed, you know, latch on it, and I'm going to give him basically the rifleman, Chuck Connors' rifle. And that's what you hear when he meets up in that scene you're talking about. He's spinning the rifle. When I say he's spinning the rifle, he's literally spinning it like Chuck Connors and the Rifleman. So that I had a little bit of that's my little personal fun with it. And, you know, that basically up until Joshua gets in front of Herrera, he doesn't want these people there. But as soon as he sees that this guy, he can see, you know, Joshua's a guy that can read a mm-hmm. person real fast, and he can read that this guy is not right. There's something hinky about him, and he's not gonna give up these people. He's gonna defend them. That's Joshua.
Well, they better not mess with him. Well, I could tell you that. And so the border control agents are corrupt. And what happens when Herrera is told that he has to? This was scary, because this does happen, I'm sure. He has to get 50 illegals into the country within 3 days, or he's dead meat too. He's telling his handler that he has things in place in case he goes missing, you know, does not seem to impress this man. You know, he's like, oh, if I'm dead, you know, I left something in the post office, or I sent a letter to someone. They don't really care. So how did you create that? I mean, no, he's corrupt. He's horrible. And people are actually told that if you don't get 50 illegals into the country within 3 days, and I wonder if some of this was for sex trafficking and drug trafficking and all of that, because I just finished another book like that. And it's horrible. Guilty Blood, Rick Acker. The deputy attorney general in California, wrote that, and oh my God, it's scary about what happens with when somebody's accused of doing something that he didn't do. So how mm-hmm. did you create that? Do people actually?
Well, it was definitely the Mexican drug cartels, definitely human traffic and drug traffic, and those avenues that they use to get illegals and to get drugs into the country can push anything into the country. Also, what they're starting to find out, and I've written three books in the Chris De Niro series that touch on this thing, is one of them directly explains it. We're just finding out now that there's a connection between the jihadis and the Mexican drug cartels. I wrote that in Project 111. There's a connection between the Iran and North Korea. There's connections out there between evil people that, you know, I think more people should know about. And so in Joshua's country, there is a connection between the jihadists, who's the main antagonist, and he has a direct connection to those drug cartels. They do business. The drug cartel, the jihadis, ISIS, Al Qaeda, Al Shabaab, all of them make a portion of their money from drug trade. They do some human trade too. They make it from drug trade, and so that those connections were there, and I highlight that in Joshua's country, so that Herrera is kind of he's a bad guy, but he's caught in an in-between situation. On one side, he has Joshua Jacobs, who he came onto Joshua's radar, which isn't a good thing if you're a bad guy down there. Mm-hmm. But at the same point, he's really answering to his you know, superiors in the Mexican cartel, who are now being manipulated by a jihadist. And so the Herrera finds himself in a really, really bad position where he has to do something. You know, Herrera's always been kind of smart. He's done these illicit things. He's gotten kickbacks on the border. And by the way, I named him Herrera on purpose. He is Spanish. I'm Spanish. And I wanted people to know that, you know, on both sides that, you know, okay, so here's this guy and he's doing, you know, smuggling in his own, you know, his fellow Hispanics. I mean, you know, just because you're a specific ethnic or whatever doesn't make you good or bad. There's good or bad in every race and ethnicity and gender and whatever. And so Herrera is not a good guy, and he gets caught in between. And so now he has to do something that he thinks is highly, highly risky, which is the smuggling in that you're talking about. And he doesn't like to do that. He doesn't like to say he's been really smart up to that point. He thinks he can hold something over the drug cartel's head with, oh, I have evidence and this and that. And that's been done before, too. And you're going to find out these cartels are diabolical. You cannot intimidate them very easily. So
if you want to live, you don't want to intimidate them very easily.
Yes.
So we have the guy that captures Joshua. Little young Josh, and that's not good. His name is Shakir. I would like to call him something else, but I'm being polite. he's Shakir, and he captured him. How does Joshua get captured? And I'm not going to tell you what happens next, but let me tell you something. You don't want to mess with this kid either. He's his grandfather's son, I'll tell you that. That's for sure.
That's right. That's absolutely right. He's you know, done a couple of tours, and so he's overseas. You know, he's in this place and right where ISIS is. And I based it. All that stuff is real. So I don't want to give away too much of it because it's more really fun to read.
Oh God!
Everything you read about it, everything about that FOB is real, including the weather pattern that happens that takes place when the attack happens. And this is going to be kind of fun. If we can bring this to screen, it's going to be a lot of fun to portray the scene with young Josh. And you know, he gets taken captive, and that was also based off a real jihadist. What these guys do is they'll kill many, they'll take some hostage, and then they get paid for the hostages. Hostage taking is huge in the Middle East and in South America. They make a good portion of their money by just grabbing people and they did it. They do it with photographers, photojournalists. I mean, they'll grab anybody. They'll grab people from the Catholic Church, nuns. They'll grab anybody they can. And so Joshua gets swept up in that. You know, what the jihadist is going to find out is, you know, maybe you shouldn't take captive the grandson of a cowboy who is pretty good special forces guy himself. So that's where that whole thing takes place.
Well, I thought what bothers me is that I can't imagine this guy Shakir is not stupid either, even though well, what can I say? How does he know where to find Katie and them? How did he know to send those messages to them? Because I have the book in front of me. Nobody's getting this one. I've got a lot of hands
out for everything. That's all based on the real life tactics. I was going to say antics of tactics of these ISIS. When they go to charge, when they go to collect money for hostage taking, they have very tech savvy people that use the internet in order to contact the family. Many times they don't like to contact the government because they know the government's public stand on dealing with hostages is that they will not deal with them. They will not pay ransom. What these hostage takers, including ISIS, is smart about is they go directly to the families, knowing that hey, you'll pay for your son, you'll pay for your grandson, and so they use the internet to locate Joshua's family. It was very easy. It's very easy to find people, especially when you're taken hostage overseas. You're in the military. If you go back home, your hometown is going to write about it. It's going to end up, here in Las Vegas, it would be in the Review Journal. People are going to write about it. As soon as it's published, everybody knows it, including the bad guys. And that's speaking about Shakir, you know, this is a guy that's had a batting average up to that point of 1,000. It's never not worked for him. He's very, very savvy. He's very, very smart. I based it, that character, I ran into a problem with my partner, Mike Greenberg, when I wrote Joshua's Country. If he was listening now, he'd kind of smile because when he read Joshua's Country, he loved it so much. And one of the things he loved so much about it was the antagonist, Shakir. He said, you've portrayed this guy so phenomenally. At the time, we were beating out Signs of War, my second book for Chris De Niro, for Legendary Entertainment, for the movies. And so we're writing a script on my second book, and he goes, gee, I think that we should seriously consider taking Shakir and putting him into, if not Signs of War, into one of the Chris De Niro novels, because we're going to bring these things to screen. And oh boy, I was kind of elated, but at the same time let down, because he doesn't belong there. He to me, he belongs where I put him. He belongs in Joshua's Country. So
I know. You know, and it says, and I have the book in front of me, it says when they find him, they send a note, your son can't escape us, we'll have his head and yours too. We know where you live, we are coming. And you change the font. It's really chilling to get something like that from a parent, but okay, when he's in prison, they try to intimidate Josh.
But you know how it is. That's there. You know, and when you take these hostage people, when you take ISIS, when you take terrorists, basically, think of a schoolyard bully on steroids. They use all the same tactics. They scare. They put fear in these people. And if you're going to contact a mother and say, "I'm going to put the head of your son," I mean, this. And guess what? I did not make those things up. It's a terrible thing to write these books, because I actually read the real things and I see the real pictures. And that's what drives, that gives me the emotion to make sure that I pay homage to those people. I feel really committed to telling the stories and not hiding. I just got, you know, I saw a couple of, you know, I get good reviews, you get bad reviews on things like that. You know, if I come across them, I don't go out to look at reviews anymore. I've been doing this too long. But if I come across one, I'll read it. And, you know, it's not just the good ones. I read the bad ones. And I see the pushback on some of the bad reviews on some of the things I read. And it's always on the, you're portraying the bad guys too violently. They're not that bad. And I'm sorry to tell you, they are. I have the evidence. It's not me. I'm actually being objective. Yes, I write subjective books. Mm-hmm. They're novels. But not on that. If anything, Fran, I underplay the grotesque horror that I see, because I don't want people. My books are not about blood and gore. My books are trying to bring a different worldview out. But there's no way I can tamp down what these terrible animals do. And so,
I agree with you 100%, because I don't even think that people realize that. I mean, they may threaten and they may want ransom, but to me, I don't think that they would let them go anywhere. I think that they would just kill anybody anyway. I wouldn't believe
that
a word they said.
They do that. I mean, we know. We've seen it. It's on YouTube. I hate to say, in this day and age, you can YouTube beheadings, but you can.
Oh, yes. And I know.
And you're going to see people lit on fire, and you're going to see people. There are things that I've seen. I'm not in the military. I write novels for a living. All right, but there are things that I've seen in the deep research from these that I can't sleep nights from. So
I can imagine.
And that's Shakir in a nutshell. Shakir, all the things that Shakir did. One thing that I can tell people, whether you like the book, whether you don't like the books that I write,
he's real.
The one
he's
thing
real,
that I can
people.
Tell you is that the bad things that these people do, I did not really make them up. I dramatized them. I incorporated them, but I didn't just stick a knife in the hand of a jihadi. The knife was in his hand, and then I saw the picture of it beheading somebody, and then I incorporated it into my novel. So.
Okay, so we have two more questions that'll prove that you don't mess with little Josh. Who are the? By the way, my nephew is a Joshua. You don't mess with him either. He's a wrestler and he's in good shape. Yeah, Josh is good. So who are the other prisoners, and how does Joshua use his intelligence, army training that was taught to him by Snake, to help them in a difficult situation? And how did you create the scenes in the truck? Those were priceless, let me tell you. I was heart stopping, and I'm saying, okay, they're going to get out. Are they going to? Is he going to do? What is he going to do? And oh my God, that's amazing.
Yeah, they swept when he was taken captive. He was taken captive from a forward operating base, from an FOB. So there are civilians there. When you go to these FOBs, there are different branches of the military there. So you're not just going to get all Marines. You're going to have Army, Marines. You may have Air Force. You may have Navy. People end up in FOBs for lots of different reasons, and you're also going to have civilian personnel. So when they took him hostage, they also took hostage a group of other people, and they may not even be people that speak English. So he ends up on these trucks to transport them, and he basically has to figure a way, how to get himself out of there, and B, what do I do? Do I leave the rest of these people here? And who can speak English, and who has any military training? So again, not to give too much away, but like you say, he does communicate with people on there, and then he goes back to, and the training he got from Snake is kind of funny stuff, because the Apaches, they were known to be some rough riding people down where they are, and occasionally get in trouble, and so they've learned some techniques. I know my dad was even a kind of a guy like that. My father was probably an Apache at heart, and there's been once or twice while my father's in the Marines that he was put into cuffs, and he said, you know those days you could just use a paperclip and you can open these things, if you had the right kind of paperclip. And so anyway, Snake teaches him some quote unquote survival skills, and Joshua ends up using them. That fit in with the narrative that I was saying, that this book was basically all low tech. I never went for the low hanging fruit and said, okay, I'm going to stick a special thing to, when you write books with Next Gen, the fun of writing James Bond kind of books, like the Chris De Niro books, is that anytime I need a weapon that, has to do like crazy things, I just invent it. Or it's probably actually even more than my own little, mind. Somebody's already invented it. I just incorporate it. And Joshua's, even the stuff that Snake teaches him is low tech. So it's fun. It's fun. It stays with the narrative.
It is. It's scary, though. So when Joshua finally goes home, this was really scary, because you would think that Shakir, he still has a score to settle because he got away. So he knows where he is, and he's not going to stop until he gets even. And we've got the agent the corrupt agent wants to play, even though you get the feeling that he doesn't really want to do this. So how does Shakir decide to come after him?
Well, and that would be more of an extraordinary thing. You don't see too many of the ISIS people that are going to carry a grudge, but that's the essence of storytelling. It's a what-if scenario, and I know that these jihadists definitely have a huge ego. Again, I do big background. When you asked me about the research before, I didn't have to really do research on jihadists or ISIS, but I did it on that particular the person that I based Shakir off of is a real person, and he has a huge ego, and he has never lost. And when people that have huge egos that never lose, they react in very, very bad ways. Usually they're sore losers. And so now Shakir is going to do the extraordinary thing of saying, hey, you didn't get away. You may have got away from me, but you're not getting away from me. I'm going to come after you. I'm going to come after you. If you went back to the United States, I'm going to come after you. I don't even know this Texas place, but I'm going to come after you there. Well, that was the whole, that's what gives me the goosebumps, because I think, there was the old Bogart line in Casablanca when Major Strasser, the Nazi Gestapo, says to him, and, what happens if we march into, England? And he says one thing, and he says, what happens if we march into New York? And he says, there's some neighborhoods in New York I wouldn't recommend.
I wouldn't recommend either.
That's right. If you're going to start the Nazis were going to invade the United States, don't start in the Bronx. You know what I mean?
Oh, don't start in the South Bronx where I grew up, let me tell you.
Exactly right. And so I have that old neighborhood thing with Brooklyn, and I know from my many, many friends and readers in Texas that if I was going to invade this country, I wouldn't start in Texas. Texas is some very fiercely independent people that have not forgotten the Alamo. So that's where that's where Shakir makes a big, big mistake, underestimating the fact that, well, I'm just going after this one guy. It's not even going to be the military that's going to back him up. He's going to have nobody but his mom and maybe this old grandpa. Well, that, you know what? There's the essence of the story. The old grandpa is a cantankerous old cowboy. He's a he's an expatriate. He's got, you know, just enough training to be dangerous, and he loves his family, and he's going to do anything he can for his, you know, his daughter-in-law and his grandson.
Well, we've got the issues in this book. We said second chances, but we've got redemption, hate, revenge, hope, family ties, trust, loyalties, not only in their family, but I got a long question, but within the basic ranch unit. How did you get all of these into the plot? Those are just some. There's more.
Actually, I think all of those are wrapped up in, and anybody listening would understand this, family.
Yeah.
What, we all have
yeah.
families, and every one of those dynamics plays out almost every day in our families. You have those definite mistakes made, redeeming qualities, things you can't take back, people that are gone, people that you miss, you know, the second chances with your grandchildren, you know, so all of those dynamics, it wasn't like I made out a list of things I wanted to cover. All I really, where the story went, was almost to use a journalism, you know, line, where the story went was family. And so all of those things came alive, and I dramatized them. I said, hey, listen, I'm going to tell this. I mean, this is as much part of the story as anything else. It's fun to read that. I think it makes stories real, for me anyway, when you see that these people are not one-dimensional. This isn't just bad guy, I guess, you know, versus good guy, and it's going to be. It's not a Rambo movie per se. Even Rambo, I think, tells good human stories. But it's not, you know, it's not that kind of story. It's a story that's, you know, there's all these things are going on while you got this bad guy that's trying to kill Joshua. So
Let me announce my after the holiday. This girl's taking a break next week. She's not going to do any shows till January 4th, when I'm going to talk to Pastor Michael Jones, PhD. He works with the homeless, does a lot of things to help different people in Florida. And I've read every one of his books because he's friends with my niece, and she told him to call me. And it's really interesting. The title of the book is How to Be a Seventh-day Adventist. And I won't write the religious stuff in my review. Michael knows that, he's read it. We're going to talk about forgiveness, you know, being good, money, family loyalty, and a whole bunch of other issues that I learned when I read the book. On the 8th, Down to No Good by Dennis Wilson. An interesting story about a man that's dead that is reincarnated and comes to life because somebody puts him back together again. It's interesting. On the 10th, we have Carrie Baldwin, Countdown. And on the 10th, we have The Last Words of Oscar Wilde, John Vanderslice. That was really good. And on the 16th, we have Carrie's book. So that's just some of January. And before I forget, happy birthday, Christopher. My nephew turns 8 today. My nephew was absolutely amazing. He's autistic. He's in a regular class in school up here, and I'm so proud of him. And yeah, I got to cater his birthday party last Sunday because he didn't want it anywhere except his aunt's house. And the good part is that I catered it and friend didn't cook. So I will see you tomorrow, Christopher. Yeah. Happy birthday, Christopher. He's 8. And he's just absolutely delightful. And I will bring you more presents tomorrow. And if I remember where to get Pokemon cards, you'll get those too. Otherwise, you get your mother Gustamine with you. Okay, the books for the holiday, get a couple of copies of Joshua's Country. While you're at it, buy all the Cristinero books because they're really good. And I just read a good book about the FDA and corruption in the FDA, Silence Her, which is really, really good. And I just finished this morning The Highs and Highs and the Lows and Lows of Bipolar Disorder. It's a true story of a young guy that's still fighting himself, within himself, and he's better, but he's not quite there yet. So those are just some. And if you don't know what to get for Hanukkah that just passed, if you missed the 8 days, you might want to get 8 copies of every Kristen Arrow book and make up for it for the people whose books you didn't buy. Seriously. So Joshua comes home. He's in the hospital. This scared the daylights out of me. And the security, how would anybody get through the security? And why didn't the nurse question when she told Joshua that he was going to be moved? He knew that something was not right. How did you create that? Is that based on real life too?
Yeah, it was based on, I looked at the way the infrastructure coordinates down at the border between Homeland Security, ICE, FBI, and you have these different authorities of who's in charge, who's supervising, who's this, who's that. Mm. And so Herrera, it now is being manipulated by Shakir. So he's able to find out. I mean, he's able to know where Joshua is being kept. We're talking about Josh Jr. And so he's using Herrera. That's why I say Herrera's in a spot. Think of two walls closing in on him, and they just keep getting closer and closer and closer. He knows he can't get out of it because the jihadi will kill him. If the jihadi doesn't kill him, the Mexican cartels are going to kill him. He's caught between a rock and a hard place, and they just keep asking more and more of him. And as a result, he's able to find out, where Josh was being kept and whether he's going to get moved. And, you know, all Shakir is focused on is he's going to murder Josh. He's going to get that payback. So, that's where I think the story is really heated up toward right at about that point, where it's the point of no return for Shakir, for Herrera. These events are going to take place now. There's no way of stopping this storm.
Yeah, he's like a little kid in a schoolyard that stamps his feet. I didn't get my way. You just wait and see what I'm going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like him at all. So we have the final scenes. And how did you create the action at the end, but we're not telling them what happens at the end? How did you create all that? It's like heart-stopping. Oh, who's going to live? Who's going to die? And, oh, my God.
Yeah, I literally, the way I write all of my books is with bunches of monitors here and with maps up so that hospital is really there. And Joshua's country is really a place on the map. You're not going to find Joshua's country there, but it's a place on the map. So I worked out what the time, in other words, all those little fun things that I love built into novels is built into Joshua's country too. So the time it takes for him to get from the hospital to get back to the ranch and where Joshua is going to stop. And it's kind of a race. Remember, the jihadis are also there. There's another terrorist event that's mentioned that's supposed to be taking place. What Shakir's basically doing is he's saying, listen, we're making the priority this one guy. He has the ability to do that. Not even the terrorists are behind what Shakir wants to do at the end. They're just following him because he's the boss. And so he knows he's running out of daylight. He can't, he can't be chasing people in the United States of America forever. He has this window of time. So he's under time pressure. Joshua's under time pressure. Junior's under time pressure. There's a lot going on there. And so it's kind of that's what takes place just as the sun is coming up on that day where the bad guy's going after the grandson, and the grandfather is going to protect. And so there's lots of kind of a chase, and then there's these skirmishes, and then it all ends up back where it started at Joshua's ranch.
Now, this is a hard question, but I think this is a question that a lot of people are wondering before we ask what's next. And I personally speaking, I think Kristen Arrow and Joshua, older Joshua, would make a great novel together. I would hate to see, I would hate to see them together, but that would be really cool because I don't think anybody can win against these two. So does anyone ever really win against terrorists? Can they ever really be stopped? And in ISIS is disaster. They're horrible. And can anyone ever stop them? And what would happen, seriously, I thought about this, what would happen if they won and everybody believed what they believed? Who would they fight next? Themselves?
Yeah. Well, again, people that know me, as long as you do, certainly, know that there is a worldview that I portray, just like Tolkien did with Lord of the Rings and others have done through their works. It's not a preaching, but I am a fundamentalist Judeo-Christian. So my outlook is, you know, the things that are playing out here are playing out. So the short answer to the question is no, there will be strife until the end of this age. There will be bad people doing bad things to the end of this age. Does that mean that the good guys lose? No, but it means that the contention is still there. So occasionally you will have these patriots and these heroes. And, you know, what I really love, Fran, you know, even with Chris was not a military ex-SEAL. He was a man who lost his – and in the case of Joshua, he lost his son and he's protecting his grandson. So my favorite story is the way I write is taking normal people and showing patriotism, showing that the normal – American, whether you're old. Another thing, you know, nowadays more than ever, there's a youth movement. So every turn on the TV, turn on the movies, go to the movies and see who the average age of the protagonist is. And yeah, okay, that's great that everybody is 20 something, but not in my world. Some of my heroes to this day, living heroes, are people that have some age on them. And so I don't mind. I get this from the people we're working with in Hollywood. They kind of laugh and they said, you know, when they met me, they thought I was going to be like 80. And they say, boy, you're so young. They start laughing. And I said, what are you talking about? And they said, well, you know, Joshua's got to be 70. And you made him a protagonist in your book. Like they think that's unusual. I don't. There were many heroes from the generations before us, and I have no problem portraying them. It's something that I guess I wish more people would do it. You know, there's a big thing to have women portrayed, strong women. Well, now we're having that, but we still don't have old. Old is not Hollywood friendly.
I agree with you because people, you know, I walk into a store, I want to say how old I am. I don't look that old. I don't look old at all. With my crazy spiky hair with different colors and my wacky outfits because my niece says to me, you look like you're a teenager. That's the goal.
Oh, you do.
Stereotyping people by age drives me crazy. And the first question
they ask
when you pull
up. Yes, and old people can be heroes. Old people are not going to be the action stars. No, I'm not going to have Joshua, you know, doing backflips or something ridiculous. But at the same point, they I think he does enough in that. I think he does enough. And you know what? I'm going to take your thought because I've gotten about a dozen so far. And, you know, Joshua's only out a little bit, and New Detroit's really the one that's making a lot of noise right now. But I have gotten things that people said they would love to see what would happen if Joshua ever met Chris. So we'll see. We'll see. That would be interesting.
Yeah, I think, you know, when somebody asks me my date of birth, I go, you know, my mom had Alzheimer's, and my new book won Best Cover of the Year for 2017. I was, like, impressed with myself. A Daughter's Promise. And A Daughter's Promise, I wasn't going to say anything, is entered in the Forward Reviews Book of the Year. Will I win? I doubt it. But you know what? Somebody entered it, and what the heck? The worst that'll happen is that they'll say, wonderful book, and we didn't like it, and whatever. You know, you got to try. So age is just a number, and it's what you do with it. I met a lady yesterday in the diner who said, I thought she was 91. And we were laughing because I said to her, you look, I thought she was like 75 or 80. She says, you know, they pick on me. I cry. Marsha Ball tells me her life story. I said, I bet you're looking for a guy that, you know, can keep you happy. She says, yeah, preferably one that's younger. It was hilarious. I mean, seriously hilarious. And she looked at me, well, you're much younger. I go, okay. And age is just, you know, whatever. Well, what is next for Chris De Niro?
And Chris De Niro, White Widow.
Where can everybody? Oh, White Widow. I didn't get that one yet. Yeah.
No, well, you can't. I'm writing it. You said, what's next? That's what's next for Chris De Niro. White Widow, I'm writing. It's the sequel to New Detroit.
And is that going to be the end, or is there going to be more about this? That character's evil too.
That's another thing.
That was really good.
I will say, New Detroit. I was a little concerned. I hadn't published a book since 13, and I was a little afraid of if the Kristen Neal readers were going to be out there and remember. And it's, you know, you take that risk, and I'll never let that happen again. By the way, there'll be regular Kristen Neal novels coming out from now on. But the ending in a cliffhanger, everybody got across that. So it's hit bestseller in UK. It hit it in Canada and in Australia, of all places. And all of these people from around the world got it and said, we love this antagonist. We'd love to see this antagonist as a recurring antagonist, which I'm not going to say whether it's going to be or not. But I'm always fascinated at how, you know, even what you were saying about Joshua meeting Chris and how people are writing in and saying that they want the widow to be a recurring antagonist. So we'll see. I write very similar to Lee Child. I don't know what's going to happen at the end of White Widow yet. So we're all going
to
find out.
If you ever decide to take her down, I would like to see Joshua and Chris take her down with little Josh together. And knowing how smart she is, she probably will hire a lawyer and get out. That's even scarier because she's so smart. Yeah. So where can everybody find out about you and your work? And I can't wait to read the next one. And you should really – I was invited, everybody, to the Thriller Fest. I will be there.
Where is the Thriller Fest?
The Thriller Fest is in the Grand Hyatt. And the good part is that I don't have to pay to go because they invite me because I review books and I'm the media. I'm the only radio person that comes. It's a lot of money.
Actually, I didn't know that. It's in New York. If I ever ended up
in
New York at the right time, I'd go.
It's in July, and it's going to be the second weekend in July. I'm going to be there the 13th, 14th. I have it on my calendar. The 13th, 14th, and 15th of July. Let me see. It's right over there. Yeah, it's the 13th, 14th, and 15th of July. It starts on the 11th on the Wednesday. And all the Thriller writers are there. They have panels, and they have the Thriller Master this year is the man, is George Martin, that writes Game of Thrones. So
sure.
I'm excited. Yeah, that's going to be fun. And the
that's
fun part is that whether they like me or not or like what I write or not, they all know who I am. So that's even I can't even go in disguise. And Kimberly Howe is the one that, if you go on the internet and look for Thriller Fest, she's the one that runs it. And I was invited, and they promised they were going to roll out a red carpet. And they better, because I'm going to be disappointed if it's not there. Anyway, so where can we find out more about you and your work?
Well, you can find out at the website, GerardDeMarini.com. You could also find them on Amazon and Google and all the major booksellers online, and at IMDb for my for the movie and the TV stuff, which will 2018 is looking really, really good. My partner Mike Greenberg right now is just finishing producing the Road to the Winter Classic for Epics, and so they're going to be shooting that game at Shea Stadium, or what do they call that stadium now? I will forever call it Shea Stadium. Yeah, so he's excited. He's a New Yorker, and you know, anytime you get to do something in Yankee or Shea Stadium. And so if anybody's out there and you're a hockey fan, or even if you're not, you watch a little bit of outdoor hockey. I think it's January 4th is the game. And that the whole production on Epics and Showtime is my partner's with his brother, Ross Greenberg. They do a fantastic documentary series on the Road to the Winter Classic. So.
Well, if you ever have an opening, you know, for your movies, I want it to be in New York so I could come. I want to sit in the front row and say, see, I read that book. It's really good. And I'll even give you a blurb because what can I say? So I want to thank everyone.
We'll pick a great
restaurant,
and I haven't been back, and
yes.
I'm looking forward to getting back to New York. And it would be great to have an opening of something over, you know, one of the great projects that I'm working on with my. So there should
be
more to come in 2018.
That would be great. And I'm actually going to be in the city. My niece is coming to visit so that she can see her aunt. I haven't seen them in a while. So I get to spoil them and spend a day of shopping in New York City in about 2 weeks. So everybody, Have a great day. Before I forget, Marcia Cook is on, is listening. Marcia and I are going to start some different shows after the new year, and we're going to talk about style, like what's your style, accessorizing, shoes, hair, makeup, anything that has nothing to do with books. We're going to have a little fun. So if you have any ideas, you know, PM them to one of us, and we'll, you know, we'll take them under advisement. But it's going to be a lot of fun to do something different that doesn't require that Fran has to read, you know, for 42 hours before. So I want to thank you so very much. I want everybody to have a great day. The sun is shining. It's beautiful outside. So what if it's 32 degrees in New York City, and it's probably a lot hotter where you are, but everybody stay safe. Have a very, very Merry Christmas. And if you don't know what to do, because it's going to snow on Monday, buy a couple of books and read. Thank you so much, Gerard. Everybody, have a great day, and bye.
Happy New Year's, everybody.